Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The gender pay gap in the U.S. is alive and well. According to data reviewed by the Wall Street Journal, the gap kicks in earlier than many people think, even among those with the same degree from the same school. It shows up in fields from the law to dentistry to accounting and persists well beyond the early workforce years. Jennifer Forsyth is the Deputy Chief of Investigations at the Wall Street Journal. She's been covering this story. Welcome to the show, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Can you give us an overview of the data you reviewed and where it came from?
Yes, this is unusual data to look at when you're talking about pay. This is not from the Labor Department. This is, in fact, from the Education Department. And it is student loan data. What happens is that because you take out a student loan, you have to then have an ID that the Education Department knows exactly how much you are making to make sure that you are paying your student loans in a steady rate.
Okay.
And so they can see exactly how much people who took out loans are making so many years out of school. And this is data that they published using those figures.
So I guess we should be clear that this is data that reflects earnings and disparities in earnings among college-educated, college graduates.
That's correct.
3 years after graduation, men's pay exceeded women's in nearly 75% of the undergraduate and graduate degree programs you reviewed. Where were some of the most stark differences that you found?
We were surprised by some of the differences that we saw. We were expecting to see it in maybe what you might call traditional male fields, petroleum engineering, for example, in which there are many more men than there are women. But one of the things that surprised us is that we found disparities somewhat across the board, even in very traditional kind of female heavy fields such as education.
And did location geography play into this at all?
No. It showed up in many different states. It didn't show up in like a disparity in regions. And one of the things that we found was that you could have people who graduated from the very same program at a school, and then the kind of the disparity, the widening, would show up even in year one in some cases, but definitely by year three. And just so you know, we valued year three more because we figure the first year people might be doing internships. They haven't really kind of established their careers yet. But by year three, we should have a very good idea of the trajectory of someone's career as they start out. And even in that very early time, we can see that the men are being hired at pay rates that are higher.
Did the school from which they graduated, did that set off any alarms? I mean, were the Ivy Leagues more in this way than, say, the state schools?
Well, let me give you a caveat about the data. So this is for those graduates who received financial aid. So for some undergraduate programs, especially at very elite, very wealthy schools, Ivy League schools, they don't have a very large percentage of students who receive financial aid. They give a lot of scholarships. So that's a little bit of a wrinkle. You couldn't see it all the time that way, but you did have schools with very fine reputations. For example, we highlighted the University of Michigan Law School, which is a very fine law school, and you still saw those disparities there. You also saw it in schools that are not among the elite schools. One of the programs that we highlighted was the Cal State Fullerton, their nursing program, for example. Very good nursing program, nothing to say about it in terms of disparaging, but it certainly isn't like an elite school. And we saw those same kinds of pay disparities with that nursing program as well.
Again, another what is a traditionally female heavy field.
That's correct.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with the Wall Street Journal's Deputy Chief of Investigations, Jennifer Forsyth, about an article, a recent reporting on gender pay disparity. It's starts earlier than a lot of studies have shown in the past, and it endures. It comes from Department of Education data, not Department of Labor data, which is unusual in and of itself. We'll have a link to that article on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Coming up in this program, we'd love to hear from listeners who have their own experiences with pay disparity, gender pay gaps. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@WOSU.org. Now, Jennifer, there are some examples of fields where women earned more than men. Can you talk about that?
Yes, there were some, although the amount in which they earned more was not nearly as dramatic. So, for example, the widest disparity in which women made more money was with women who have English degrees, and the median of the median salaries that we looked at was about a 6% benefit to women. Whereas we found lots of programs in which the men made 10% or more 3 years out of school.
What about academia?
I will tell you that for the most of those jobs, those are PhD jobs, and we did not look at those so closely because there's another caveat with the data. The education department suppresses programs in which there are not a lot of graduates, just to make sure that you can't figure out someone's individual salary.
Yeah.
And so PhD programs tend to not have a lot of graduates in any one year. So they were not as good of a litmus test. So we focused our analysis on undergraduate programs with a lot of graduates and fairly large graduate school programs.
How did scholars of this topic respond to this data?
Intrigued is the way I would put it. They focus most of their research on a little bit later years, because that's what the Bureau of Labor Statistics data is rich with. And so they had always assumed that what happened is that men and women kind of got hired at about the same rates. And then as the careers progressed, if women took a step back, or if they were perceived to be somehow maybe not as dedicated to their careers, you would start to see a gap emerge and then widen. So they were surprised that we were seeing it so early, that this could not be attributed to a step back by women for child rearing years. And they say that they believe that there needs to be a lot more study now on these early years and what could be the factors behind them.
Right, because that affects everything about the strategies to reverse this trend.
That's right.
Thinking that it happens later, and I guess you're talking about women, like, say, childbearing years, that kind of a thing, or get married, all of that.
That's correct. What we already knew is that there was a disparity that shows up in child rearing years for women, and that it kind of grows over time, that it is kind of at its height at about age 50 for women. But what we didn't really understand is that the disparity began, albeit at a smaller delta, much earlier in women's careers.
What about employers? What kind of feedback did you get from them about this?
You know, I think the employers themselves were surprised. And, you know, it depends who exactly you're talking to. But I do think that a lot of employers are making very strong, good faith efforts to try to minimize discrimination in the workplace. And I think they thought they had factors in place to do this. But the reasons behind this is very complex, and I want to be clear about that. In some cases, this was simply about the choices that people make within the programs. So, for example, we highlighted Cal State Fullerton's nursing program, but the school says that the women tend to choose lower paying careers within that degree, such as becoming a midwife, whereas the men tended to choose the higher paying fields within that degree, such as anesthesiology. But we found that there was this disparity even when there was not really any kind of track within a program. Like for dental school, for example, there you're a dentist or you're not a dentist. There's not a soft track and a hard track to dentists, and yet the disparity showed up there as well.
Dentists are also tend to be, although this might be changing a lot, business owners, right? So they're running their own business. I'm wondering if that plays a role in it.
That's
Women.
one of the things that the dental school has told us was in fact indeed a factor, and the women themselves said that too. And this plays into kind of some of the societal signals that we explored in the article. Women said that they often felt reluctant to go straight into owning their own business, their own clinic, immediately after dental school, that they wanted to get more experience, that they felt like they didn't have a sense of the business side enough in their dental school training, whereas the men were confident and went straight in and started their own clinic. So these were decisions that the women made, some of which were, things that probably could be remedied by a dental school, but some of them are very much kind of like embedded in the way women and men think about their own careers.
Another issue that we've talked about on the program before is how women negotiate differently and value themselves differently. They tend to be more critical in a kind of an intellectual way of their work and what it's valued at.
That's right. Study after study has shown that women are less, they are way too reluctant to advocate for themselves in a lot of different ways in in their careers. They are hesitant to ask for more money. They're hesitant to ask for promotions. They're hesitant to ask for raises once they have once they've been hired. And even when companies say that they're trying to remedy those things, it's still much, very much a factor in most people's jobs that they have to make those decisions and those requests on their own. They can't wait for the company to do that for them. And women are just more reluctant to do that.
Another topic that is we've talked about is the boardroom and who's in the boardrooms. They tend to be still almost monopolized still by white males. There's obviously been some headway on that score, but do you have any sense about what it looks like at the top and how that's reflected at the bottom?
Anecdotally, yes. We talked to one woman who was a University of Michigan law grad, which is one of the schools we highlighted in our article. And she was wanting to get a job in a corporate law firm. And she interviewed with 10 that the University of Michigan career folks had made available to her. And in all of those interviews, there was only one woman. And so she it wasn't like, and she did not get an offer from any of those firms. She has no idea if that had anything to do with it. Maybe she didn't interview well. She concedes that. But she said she never felt very comfortable in those interviews and felt like she was having a hard time making a connection with the people she was interviewing.
So that brings me to another disconnect on that score, and that would be race. Anything jump out at you that way?
Unfortunately, we could not explore race in this particular data set. It was a frustration of ours. The education department disclosed this information broken down by gender for the first time, but they did not break it down by race. And that is a detriment to our analysis because we know from previous studies that Black women make less than white women, for example. And so, race does play into this, and would be a much more granular and interesting analysis if we could do it. And we're hoping that the education department will release that at a future time.
Did you learn in your reporting how the pay gap affects the workforce in the long run?
Well, so keep in mind, this is very early. This is the first time that anybody even really knew this data was in
Right.
there. So what we do know is that the Department of Education is saying that it will release more of this data over time. So, for example, they gave us year one and year three but they say they'll start releasing year four, year five, year six. So we should be able to, interestingly, follow this cohort of graduates, which was from 2015 and 2016, for many years to come.
At least until they pay off their loans.
Is a good question. We may even have it after that.
Oh, okay.
Because they still would have access to that information with that person's... it's possible. I don't know the answer to that, but I think they could still track them after that because they'll still have their social security numbers.
Okay, interesting. Well, Jennifer Forsyth, I really appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
It was my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Jennifer Forsyth is the Deputy Chief of Investigations at the Wall Street Journal. We've been talking about a project they just completed looked at Department of Education data that shows that the pay gap between men and women kicks in earlier than previously thought, even among men and women with the same degree from the same school. If you have a question or comment going forward, we're going to be talking to some folks about who look at this in detail and are very familiar with the pay gap issue. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Department of Education wage data from recent college graduates has revealed a gender pay gap that emerges soon after joining the workforce, even among those receiving the same degree from the same school. We're taking a look at what this means to our understanding of the gender pay gap and strategies for improving equity. Yana Rogers is a professor of labor studies and employment relations at Rutgers University, where she serves as the faculty director of the Rutgers Center for Women and Work. Yana Rogers, welcome to All Sides.
Hi, Ann. It's nice to be here. Good morning.
Good morning. So a wage gap between men and women opens up very shortly after entering the workforce. That's very new information. It's been previously thought that it occurs later on when other things kind of siphon women from the workforce and that sort of thing. What does it tell you about the issue?
I'm not surprised. And I teach a lot of young people, college students, and they seem surprised that there's a gender wage gap. So this kind of information, as you just implied, is new for them. And I think the main thing that's happening here, it's still the same old story. It's just happening sooner now that in the U.S., women are being penalized for having children. And that is affecting the jobs they choose or the jobs that they are hired into. It's not always a choice. Some of the salary negotiations that they engage in or the pay that they're offered. We no longer have, you know, overt gender discrimination. But what's happening here, I think, is more subtle, and it's related to women having children. That is the number one reason in the U.S. for the gender wage gap.
How does just supposing that when you're first out of college, getting your first job, that kind of a thing, you're not having a baby, you're not necessarily married as young. I mean, we know that the statistics tell us that as well. Women are waiting longer to get married, they're waiting longer to have children. So how does it affect them so early in their career that way, do you think?
Yeah. Well, I believe the story that ran was that this is starting a few years after graduation, college graduation. And that is typically when people will start to look for those promotions or look for another job, maybe another occupation, or start to negotiate their first salary increase. And this is where we get into some of those subtleties that they may be passed over because they might not have a baby yet, but the employer thinks, oh, baby just around the corner, maybe I'll promote this other person instead. And it's very difficult to prove that these are instances of discrimination, but some of that is happening. There's also some studies showing that women are a little less aggressive in negotiating for higher salaries. So that may be a little bit at what's at play. And overall, what we see in the gender wage gap is differences in the kinds of occupations that men and women are getting into or chosen. That's the main explanation again for the gap. And that could be happening, you know, a few years again after college. So there's a lot going on. It's difficult to tease out, but a lot of it does boil down to gender differences in the work that's happening at home and in caregiving at home, and those constraints that are placed on women as they advance in the labor market.
Whether or not they ever get married or have children.
Exactly.
It was unfortunate that the data released by the Department of Education didn't include racial breakdowns as well, because there's probably a larger number. I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, what do you think about that?
Absolutely. You're so right. That if we were to look at, for example, Equal Pay Day this past year, the current year, Equal Pay Day was on March 15th for all women. And that signifies that women on average needed to work until March 15th of this year to earn what on average a man would have earned by the end of last year. But if you look at Equal Pay Day for African-American women and even Hispanic women, those happen much later in the year. So the differences are much more severe for women of color relative to, let's say, white men. We see substantially larger earnings gaps. And for Hispanic women, it's just a little bit more than 50% of what Hispanic women earn on, or Latina women earn on average compared to white men.
And it's all compared to white men, but Hispanic Latino women also earn significantly less than Hispanic Latino men.
Yes, there's wage gaps within racial ethnic groups, and there are wage gaps across racial ethnic groups, gender wage gaps, and even among just women. White women on average earn more than Black women and Latina workers.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're This show today is inspired by an article out of the Wall Street Journal recently that shows that Department of Education data on wages earned by college graduates who received federal student aid showed a pay gap emerging between men and women soon after they joined the workforce, even among those receiving the same degree from the same school. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guest is Yana Rogers. She's a professor of labor studies and employment relations at Rutgers University, where she serves as the faculty director of the Rutgers Center for Women and Work. I wanted to go back because I think this is kind of key. The editor from the Wall Street Journal that I just interviewed, Jennifer Forsyth, said that they really looked at that third year because they thought that's when people are out of their internship phase, they're out of their gap year phase or whatever, and it's going to be more useful. But it also, as you pointed out, it's that point where a lot of people are getting their first salary job or they're negotiating their first salary increase. So everyone maybe hypothetically sort of starts out at the same way in the same beginning, but when we get to those negotiation phases, that very first one, it could have that big of an impact right off the bat.
Absolutely. Both salary increases, but even, you know, promotions, yeah, or slightly different job titles. When we look at the statistics, you know, we see quite a bit of occupational segregation. So men and women do cluster in different jobs, and men tend to cluster in jobs that pay more. But the data still show pay gaps within occupational categories. So then we may have, you know, small differences in within these occupations in grades of what those jobs are, or as you suggested, in what people are negotiating in terms of pay or what they're being offered in terms of pay within those occupations. So we do see pay gaps within detailed occupational categories.
Nurses, childcare workers, teachers, all are examples of demanding professions doing important work and fields that are dominated, at least traditionally dominated, that's changing and not, well, it's starting to even out a little bit, but dominated by women. And it's also generally accepted that they are underpaid. And that makes me wonder about the long-term implications of these kinds of this kind of data. What does it mean going forward long-term? Does it, are certain fields devalued because they're dominated by women?
Oh, that is such an incredibly good question. And the jobs that you mentioned especially involve care. And in this country and many others, care is undervalued or not valued. Care for children, whether it be provided by unpaid folks like parents, you know, or provided by paid care workers who are not paid enough. This country does not value care enough, and it does have repercussions for the long term in terms of the education quality that young people are getting. And as we've been learning during this pandemic, the quality of our healthcare system. You know, we can only be as healthy as the health of our paid care providers. And if they are not valued, if they're underpaid, if they're not getting adequate personal protective equipment, our healthcare workforce won't be as healthy and we won't be as healthy as a result. So we really need to do more to value care and to value care work.
Let's take a call from Tara in Athens. Is it Tara or Tara? Hi.
Hi. Yeah, it's Tara.
Okay. Welcome.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I'm really glad to hear this conversation. And I just heard again about this piece of valuing care, which comes to my point and my comment is that really what we're talking about to me seems evaluation of male labor over and a devaluation of female perceived labor. And the system, it seems, is really just biased and stacked against women. And so if we're thinking about the negotiation comment of women don't make as much because when they're negotiating, they're not as aggressive. And we know through various studies that in fact, the ways that women are perceived when they're negotiating firmly are negatively perceived. And so they're kind of damned if they do and they're damned if they don't.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that's just one. That's just one comment.
It's a good comment, Tara. Thank you. Yana Rogers. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly what Tara just said. We refer to that as the double bind. That if women are assertive about their needs and in their negotiations, they are perceived as unlikable. And if they are likable and friendly and take on more, you know, what are considered feminine attributes, then they don't do as well in negotiations and they are not paid as much. So, yes, some of that is indeed going on, although, you know, most of the academic studies on the gender wage gap are finding that the biggest reason is occupational segregation, the clustering of women in jobs that generally pay less than those of men. But some of these negotiation differences are at play as well.
Thank you, Tara, for that call. Appreciate it. Long-term implications of this, what do you see on the horizon?
Yeah, well, there's been, again, some work done showing that year after year, these salary differences or wage differences build up. And over the course of a typical woman's working career, she may ultimately earn less than $1 million compared to what a man is earning over his career. And again, those differences are larger for women of color. So these differences do build up, and they may cause, you know, to use the economics jargon, an inefficient allocation of resources. Women's work is a resource. It contributes vitally to gross domestic product or national income. And if our talents and work is not being used as efficiently, there could be repercussions in terms of slower GDP growth. So this has implications for the macro economy.
Right, because let's just go back, say, 50 years when colleges were dominated by men, primarily, maybe more, I guess. let's go back 70 years.
Okay.
And so most of the people graduating from college 70 odd years ago were male, and making more money than women, more money than their female counterparts. No question about that. But as women come to dominate college campuses and graduation classes, this means that the inequity is being spread out among, or is not being spread out, but it's being, it's among a much larger group of Americans now.
Absolutely. Yes, it used to be that part of the wage gap was explained by women having less education on average than men. Now, on average, women have more education. We have a higher percentage of students that are women than men. So a gender gap in education is not explaining the wage gap, that it's really coming through other differences, again, largely through the occupations that women hold. I did want to bring in, and it may be something you don't want to talk about, but it's highly relevant today with Roe v. Wade, that there is a link between women's reproductive health and access to reproductive health services and their labor force participation. A number of studies have shown that women have greater labor force participation when they have full access to a full set of reproductive health services, including access to abortion, and their ultimate salaries are higher. So again, it's maybe not something that you want to talk about
today, but it is
a factor at play in terms of contributing to the occupations women are in, to their labor force attachment and what they can earn.
Yeah, I would imagine it's something you're going to be watching very closely going forward.
Yes, especially in Ohio. And in researching a little bit for this segment, I went to the website and a great resource, the Institute for Women's Policy Research. They rank all the states on the status of women, both economically and politically, and their health. And unfortunately, Ohio does not do that well in the IWPR's ranking. They're ranked 37th among all states and get close to a failing grade.
That's before the overturning of Roe.
And that was before the overturning of Roe. So for listeners on the program, there's a lot they can do in terms of advocacy, you know, contacting state representatives and pushing for those kind of policies that support women's health and support women's advancement in the labor market.
My guest is Yana Rogers. She is a professor of labor studies and employment relations at Rutgers University, where she serves as the faculty director of the Rutgers Center for Women and Work. We're talking about the persistent wage gap in the United States. We're finding now, because of Department of Education data that's been now newly released, that it opens up earlier than previously believed. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the gender pay gap and strategies for improving equity. Still with us is Yana Rogers. She's a professor of labor studies and employment relations at Rutgers University, where she serves as the faculty director of the Rutgers Center for Women and Work. Kelsey Fields is the director of operations at the Women's Fund of Central Ohio. Welcome to the show, Kelsey.
Thank you so much for having me.
What does the gender pay gap look like in Ohio?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so when we look at pay, Ohio is actually very similar to national trends. So we all know that women earn less compared to white men. And when we kind of break down what the average woman is, we know that the pay gap is much worse for women of color. What we're really focused on at the Women's Fund, however, is actually the wealth gap, because we know that the pay gap is only a small part of what women actually own. And when we look at the wealth gap, the disparity is much greater. So on the dollar compared to single white men, women own about 40 cents to the dollar. When we look at Black women, for example, they own only 2 cents to the dollar. So we're really focused on different wealth accelerators and decelerators that would help women not only close the pay gap, but also close the wealth gap.
Right. This is Yana Rogers, where women have to wait longer to buy a house, have to wait longer to buy a better car, that kind of a thing.
Yes, house and car and other kinds of assets.
Investments, again, that kind of thing.
Yes, investing in the stock market. So all of these different kinds of assets. And what Kelsey mentioned, it's kind of a double whammy for women, but also for women of color. We see a large racial disparity in savings and in asset ownership in the U.S.
And how much of a function is that of women as head of family, Kelsey Fields?
Yeah, that also is definitely part of it. We know that there are obviously many single mother households, many single households are led by women. And we also know that women disproportionately make up the share of our country's caretakers, whether it's caring for children, caring for elderly, caring for other community members. Women overwhelmingly are caretakers. And so that definitely plays a part of it as well.
Right. That's the point you made, Yana Rogers, is as a country, we don't value caretakers in general, regardless of the gender necessarily. They just happen to be dominated by women.
Yeah, exactly. And I think some of this is also bringing in age issues, that if we look at more senior, mature women, I don't want to say older women, we may see more instances of, in opposite sex households of women having let their husbands be the only ones with the names on a deed, or women having taken time off out of the labor market. And when they retire, their pensions are smaller, or if they didn't work at all, then they have very little pension and savings. So some of this, I think, is generational as well. We may see more asset ownership among younger women, but more mature women less, because of what was considered normal, back when they were younger, and making decisions like who gets their name on a mortgage or on a deed of a house.
Well, I mean, it's changed now, but back in the day, women couldn't get their name on a deed, or they couldn't get their own checking account, or they couldn't get their own credit card. That's changed, but there is legacy from that, right, Kelsey Fields?
Yeah, absolutely, because it has changed, like you mentioned, but it wasn't that long ago. Even people that I work with, remember experiencing some of these barriers, and especially when it comes to wealth, generational wealth is so important. Are women not only able to build wealth, but are they able to have wealth to pass down to their children and their grandchildren? And so it's really a long-term problem, and it's existed for so long that even with some recent changes in the past 50 years, the problem, persists.
Well, let's see, Susan in Omaha, you're on the air. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I think this might emphasize, say, the need for a universal basic income, and especially the child care tax credit, to show that caring for children is indeed important, and it's a contribution to society, rather than saying caring for children is considered to be not valuable and a detriment. So, that doesn't directly affect the income gap, but I think it's a philosophy of society that should be considered as well.
Thanks, Susan. Jana Rogers, what about something like that?
Susan raises such an excellent point, and it has to do with this question, who pays for the kids? And in the U.S. historically, it's largely been families and parents that bear the bulk of the cost of paying for kids. But our government can do more to provide, tax incentives, subsidies, credits, and help with paying for the kids. And Susan mentioned the child tax credit. We had some of that going on during the pandemic with parents receiving emergency assistance, and some states are continuing with that even as the pandemic eases. And that is a great way to help working parents in terms of financing the cost of raising children, which is considerable.
I wanted to ask both of you, and I'll start with you, Kelsey Fields, just what we learned from the pandemic and how it might change this dynamic for the better or for the worse.
Yeah, the pandemic, it really has been such a reversal of progress for so many women. Some of the research that we had conducted at the Women's Fund was prior to the pandemic. So now some of the numbers that I had shared were, before the pandemic was even in the United States. And what we know is that it's made it only so much worse. I think an interesting sort of anecdote to that is that Equal Pay Day was earlier this year. So on the surface, it seems like we're making progress. But what the Equal Pay Day actually fails to include is all the women that had to leave the workforce altogether to care for children, and not including all the women that work part-time and were already working multiple part-time jobs to make ends meet. I think the pandemic has not, it has really enlightened problems that already existed. I think more people are talking about things publicly, like, universal childcare, expanded child tax credits, and things like that. I do think there's more conversation about it, and I hope that that will continue as the pandemic, continues to change and wane.
Yeah, Professor Rogers?
Yes, as Kelsey said, we saw more women leaving the labor market completely than men in order to care for kids who were home because schools were closed and daycare centers were closed. We also saw relatively more job loss due to business closures for women than men because they were clustered again in service occupations that could not be done over Zoom. So tended to see more employment losses for women, but also in people who did stay employed, frontline workers were disproportionately female. And these were workers who continued to go to work at the height of the pandemic when there was still no vaccine, and they faced much greater risk of getting exposure to the virus. These workers were disproportionately women, and they were also disproportionately Black workers and Latinx workers, as well as immigrants. Now, research that we're doing now shows that immigrant workers were largely in frontline jobs where they were more exposed to the virus.
Earlier this morning, just reading something, very quickly saw someone saying that the pandemic and our switched at home working, remote working and that kind of a thing would be good more racial equity in the offices. And someone pushed back right away and said, yeah, no way would it be better. And it made me wonder, and they made an argument for why it wouldn't be better because out of sight, out of mind. But I'm thinking the same thing for women. Does that remote workforce model that has emerged from the pandemic, Kelsey Fields, is there any indication to you that that's going to be better for women?
Some women, definitely. I think that this pandemic showed that more flexibility across the board for all people really benefits families, especially in the wake of something like a pandemic, when men and women and everyone are having to take care of children and balance different responsibilities. So I think across the board, the pandemic has given workers more flexibility, which of course would help women who are already balancing those different priorities. Although I do think the other benefit of it is that I think a lot of other people are now starting to appreciate and value, to Jana's point earlier, the value of caretaking. And, a lot of times that's not paid or it's not seen, it's not talked about, but it's disproportionately done by women. And I think people are starting to value that more and to see what that actually looks like more.
Yeah. Jana Rogers, any thoughts about that?
I agree with everything Kelsey just said, and just wanted to add to that another group of workers we haven't talked yet about in the past few minutes is workers with disabilities.
Yeah.
And our research at Rutgers is also showing that that people with disabilities were disproportionately hit with job losses, again, because they were working in those occupations that were not amenable to working from home. And our research shows that for people who could work from home, that that option indeed has been valuable for people with disabilities, especially women with disabilities and people of color with disabilities. So the more jobs that we can make amenable to working from home or having other kinds of accommodations, it will be good for women and their caregiving responsibilities, as Kelsey said, but it will also be good for people with disabilities, especially working from home.
The Wall Street Journal editor I talked to earlier in the program made the point that who sits in the boardroom still is an issue for women. It's still boardrooms across the country, from the law firms to the big corporations, are still dominated by white males. Kelsey Fields, and she talked about a University of Michigan graduate, a law school graduate, who went interviewed at 10 firms and saw one woman in the whole interview process. That's got to have an effect, not just on women, but also people of color. Kelsey Fields?
Yeah, absolutely. We talk a lot about sexism and gender bias here at the Women's Lens. And I think what makes it so insidious is that sometimes it's not on purpose. Of course, there obviously is overt sexism and racism, but it can be really insidious because you sometimes don't see what you're not looking for. And I think it's really easy for all of us to relate to that when we are, whether we're making friends or hiring new people, we naturally gravitate towards people that remind us of ourselves. And so I think it's really important.
It cuts both ways. Yeah.
Right. And I think it's really important that we start to notice that and that we start to call that out with, you know, our friends and our colleagues, because that's ultimately how this will change over time. There's, you know, we obviously want to end gender bias. There's so many policies that we could put in place that would help women. But there's also these more latent forms of gender bias and discrimination that are much harder to see. So they're much harder to change.
In some countries, they have laws, Yana Rogers, not in the United States. I mean, boardrooms have to be gender equal, that kind of a thing, but not here. That makes a difference.
That's correct. A number of countries have quotas for political offices as well as boardrooms. And there's been research done looking at the effectiveness of that quotas. We don't see those kind of quotas in the US, but what we are seeing is more and more companies, institutions, universities have DEI offices, diversity, equity, and inclusion. They have officers, they have offices, they have policies, they have trainings. As to how effective, you know, the trainings are, that is a little bit at question, but I think it is a move in the right direction that we have these officers at corporations and universities that are pushing for greater diversity, equity, and inclusion. And ultimately, that should be a move in the right direction. And let's hope it's a big move.
Yeah, Kelsey Fields, I'll let you have the last word on that. What about changing requirements for boardrooms?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like it would be only a positive thing for women. But I also think, you know, beyond just the requirements, I think it's also important to think about, then what is the culture like when women get into those roles, when women of color get into those roles? You know, what does retention look like? What do policies look like that would make them stay at a company? I think all of those are really important factors. And then, of course, you know, circling back to the beginning, the pay equity. Even if they're in those seats, are they getting paid equally? Are they getting paid what their counterparts are paid?
That is Kelsey Rogers. I'm sorry, Kelsey Fields is Director of Operations at the Women's Fund of Central Ohio. It's a public foundation focused on gender equity. Kelsey, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Yana Rogers, a professor of labor studies and employment relations at Rutgers University, where she serves as the faculty director of the Rutgers Center for Women and Work. Yana Rogers, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, Anne.
And thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.